Who the heck is Helen? Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z as part of Natural Alternatives radio shows. And we've been doing this show, I guess, since the very beginning of the station. It's Gary Knowles Network here, and we get so much feedback, and we'd love to get yours. Just visit naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse, and we'd be happy to give you information about our many classes, which are both online and on ground. We go out and actually look at edible and medicinal wild plants, and we teach people how to make them into medicine, great survival tool, as well as a lot of fun. And today, we are so happy to have as our guest, Rebecca Murray. Rebecca is a board-certified family nurse practitioner for over 20 years. And I hear a little disturbance there. Okay, do we have Rebecca on the line?
Yes, you do.
Okay, very good. I'm not sure what that buzz was, so we'll ignore that. So let me finish recognizing who you are, Rebecca, because it's amazing that you've been doing this for so long, specializing in the integrative approach to the prevention, evaluation, and treatment of medical problems. And you graduated from Columbia University and worked in critical care medicine. And also, you have a master's degree in primary health care as an advanced practice registered nurse, and you are currently an assistant professor at Yale University and a preceptor as well. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
Now, I am also involved with the American Holistic Nurses Association. I came back recently from their national conference, and I've been doing holistic medicine since 1964. And I'm always interested to know what brought you, obviously you have a lot of excellent training, conventional training. I don't call that traditional, by the way. I use the word traditional when we talk about things like herbal medicine, Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, Ayurvedic medicine. But you have both. You really have spanned both venues. So what made you have an interest in the natural side of interventions?
Well, as you said, I've been involved in critical care medicine for many years, starting out as a staff nurse in the intensive care unit, got promoted to being the supervisor and director of all the critical care units in the hospital. And I did that for 12 years. And, you know, if somebody's involved in an accident or something, you know, you need to go to a hospital. You need emergent care. But I felt like by the end of the night, because I did this for the evening shift, by the time it came to 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, I felt like what I was doing was just running around trying to pick up the pieces of a person's life that was in crisis. And when I would look at what they were admitted with, I thought to myself, you know, if I had gotten to this person 10 years ago, could have probably prevented that person from needing the services of critical care or the coronary care unit. Invariably, I would be the person coordinating the admission to the coronary care unit. You know, male, give you an example, male, late 40s, chest pain, admitted with a massive MI. I so affectionately say they just blew out the left side of their heart, and now they're a cardiac cripple for the rest of their life. And I'm thinking, you know, this person worked so hard, and now they are suffering the ravages of what I call not taking care of themselves, eating the westernized diet, under stress, may or may not have been smoking. And so I made the decision I was going to go back to school, and I wanted to become a preventative nurse practitioner. So I got my master's in primary health care, which is what you need to do. You need to get a master's degree in still the basic allopathic type of training. But what I did after that is just immersed myself in all the additional training that was available out there, like Institute of Functional Medicine, Dr. Jeffrey Bland, who I credit with being my mentor from afar for so long. Every time I see him, I thank him for that. Going to that, applying functional medicine to clinical practice, all of the webinars that I could lay my hands on, any type of conference. So basically, after I received my training as a nurse practitioner, I took advantage of everything, including listening to your webinars for Designs for Health, to learn. And so every day I find myself learning every day, which is what's so exciting about this, is because every day there's something else to learn. And I look back to the way people have been treated for chronic health problems. They didn't need to be admitted to the ICU. I look at them and I say, you know, there's an underlying process that needs to be addressed. What I pride myself in my practice is that I say, I try to get to the underlying problem and correct it. I am not going to prescribe for you numerous Band-Aids to try to cover it up, because it doesn't take care of the foundational problem.
You know, that's so exciting,
because
here you are functioning. Yes, of course, I am. But isn't it fantastic that here you are at mainstream, really? I mean, you work at Yale, you have every kind of conventional degree. And don't you think, rather than calling this the new medicine, it's actually just good medicine, because everything you're talking about is evidence-based.
I totally, totally agree. You know, when people come to me, and it's really fun, because I tell people I practice integrative medicine. Well, they use all the different terms. And one thing I do not like when they say is, oh, you practice alternative medicine?
And
me
I say,
too, well,
yeah.
What are you saying alternative is? Are you thinking this is alternative to good medicine? I say, you know, because the other term that I really love is integrative, and they'll say, well, what do you mean by integrative? I said, I will look at the whole entire body. I will look at all of the systems. And just to clarify that just a tad bit more before I go on to my total definition of integrative, is that I find people come to me after they've been to numerous specialists. So they'll have been to an endocrinologist that looks at maybe their blood sugars being out of control, because that's an endocrine problem. They will have been to a neurologist because they've started to experience some tingling in their feet. And then they've been to an orthopedist because they have problems with their joints and they have pain. And then they've been to a gastroenterologist because they feel bloating after they eat or have problems with constipation alternating with diarrhea. And I will get a history on them, and I see that they've been to like five different specialists that view that organ system that they specialize is the origin of the problem, and they need to give them a prescription to overcome it.
In addition, of course, as you said, each of those individual physicians don't check in with the other physicians. And what we find,
correct,
and I'm sure you find, is each of them have done prescribing for those individual items they're assessing. And yet, there's tons of, let's say, drug-drug interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the
mm-hmm.
symptoms they're developing are actually adverse effects, both due to the medication and due to the nutrients those medications deplete. And nobody
yes.
is looking at that.
I totally agree with you, and if I could just use one little teeny-weeny example to support you with that. I am a diabetes specialist, and so, problems with beginning what we call peripheral neuropathy is something that obviously I'm very, very interested in. Well, the person can also have problems digesting their food, because we also know that these people have problems with secreting, natural enzymes from their stomach. So they complain of bloating. So the gastroenterologist or whomever will put them on a PPI, and that's a proton pump inhibitor, which, without naming it, is, you know, an example would be the purple pill. Love the advertisements on TV. If you're not on the purple pill, you're not in. You don't know what it is, but ask your doctor if it's appropriate. Love that commercial, huh? So now they take a PPI. Now, a PPI is supposed to prevent the secretion of hydrochloric acid from the parietal cells in your stomach lining, because they think that acid has to do with acid production and, you know, gastroesophageal reflux disease or heartburn. Okay. But what people don't realize is that you absolutely need hydrochloric acid to absorb vitamin B12. So now they can't absorb their B12, and we know that neuropathy can be associated with a B12 deficiency. Nobody's checking it. They don't have any supplemental B12, and not that they could absorb it, because they can't, being on a proton pump inhibitor. And so it's a round robin. They are now complaining of more neuritis. So now they go to the neurologist, and now they put them on medications for pills. I can remember one person put them on a particular medication, the generic, I don't know, of Topamax, but, you know, thought it would work. And now you've got problems from that medication. And then they see somebody else, and then they give them another medication to counteract the effects of that one. And before I know it, what I could say is I could just see the person for like 12 side effects and use all of the ICD-9 codes for that. So it is. It's a huge round robin that nobody communicates with anybody else. Nobody looks at what the organ system, other organ systems in the body that are being affected by the medications they put them on. So I pride myself on getting them off many medications. And I'm not saying that, you know, somebody should willy-nilly, you know, when a person comes in, just say, you're off everything. That is not good medicine. You have to look at what each medicine is targeting, looking at the side effects, looking at which ones can be weaned down, which ones need appropriate nutritional support. And it is a process, because I tell all of my patients, one thing can be assured of is I will do them no harm. And if you take somebody off all of their antihypertensive medicines all of a sudden and they have a stroke, then you've done them harm. So I tell them I will look at the whole picture. And then, this is my further definition of integrative medicine, is I'm going to integrate every modality out there that is going to help their body function better, so that they will not need artificial chemicals to hide their symptoms.
Exactly, and that's a perfect definition of integrated. Well, you know, we're going to go to a little break right here, believe it or not. It's time for we'll go for a little break right here, and you finish that discussion. And when we come back, we'll continue with a topic that I know is near and dear to your heart and which you have helped so many women with, which is PCOS, and we'll define that when we get back. We'll be
looking
right
forward
back.
To it.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back with Rebecca Murray, advanced care nurse practitioner, and very shortly right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called tham, which we believe is thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the natural medicine chest.
The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, I want to thank you so much for joining us and remind you that we love your feedback. So visit us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse and let us know topics you'd like to hear about, questions you may have, and, you know, you may want to look for a practitioner such as Rebecca Murray, our guest today. And Rebecca is a board-certified nurse practitioner. She has been doing this a very long time, and we are so fortunate to have her on as our guest. She is an assistant clinical professor of nursing at Yale University and also a preceptor for Yale University students at the Westside School-based Health Center, and has her own private practice in Groton, Connecticut, specializing in holistic and integrative medicine. Thank you so much for joining us back again as our guest today, Rebecca. Now,
again, my pleasure.
You are filled, so there's no reason for even someone to try to make an appointment with you. It sounds like your private practice is filled, but you're able to exponentially increase the number of practitioners who will be able to practice this really integrative approach, which I call best medicine, just by the fact that you are their clinical professor. Are you able to share some of your knowledge with your students?
Yes, I am. But one of the other things that I really enjoy doing is I actually go across the country and do lectures on the weekend, which is filled with attendees who are doctors, a lot of times even specialists. I've had endocrinologists come, and that's where I really, really feel I can help. In fact, since I've talked to you last, I have formed a consulting that is going to be mostly done by email so that if a person is interested where I may be lecturing or anything like that, I don't know, I can do it at the end or now or whatever, but since my office visits are pretty much filled, but, you know, what the wonderful thing about the Internet is that you can be answering questions at 12 o'clock at night from your home.
So, that's wonderful until your life partner tells you, get off that computer.
Yeah, right.
Please do give us any contact information.
Since I've talked to you last, I have now formed this LLC with another person as a health educator, and what you can do is give more information about this topic or where I might be lecturing, things that I may be doing, other topics, questions that they have made. So the name of the email is Ward Murray HCC. So that's WardMurrayHCC, which stands for Healthcare and Consulting, at yahoo.com. So again, Ward Murray HCC at yahoo.com, and that's Murray with an AY.
Okay, that's good, because I know that you had been reluctant to give out information to contact you
for my regular right. But now that I do have help with the emails, I am able to.
Excellent.
Thank you
for that.
Yes.
Now, let's focus now on a topic mm-hmm. that I know you are truly an expert at, and that is what we were going to focus on today. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's for women's health, but it's something that really can help everybody as well.
Oh, I call it for men's health, too, because if they're dealing with a female in their life who has it, they are probably suffering some of the ramifications of...
Right. Now, this is PCOS. So tell us about, what does that stand for, starting off? People may not know.
PCOS stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome. But the title itself can be extremely misleading. If you actually Googled it in terms of other synonymous names, another name is called Stein-Leventhal syndrome. And that actually stemmed from the fact that in the early 1900s, there were two doctors in the Boston area, Dr. Stein and Dr. Leventhal, that were seeing a number of overweight women who had facial hair, or otherwise known as hirsutism, and they were having no periods, and they had a lot of weight gain through the middle. And when they did x-rays, because back in the early 1900s they didn't have ultrasounds, but even on x-rays they could see that the ovaries had lots of cysts on the outside. So their ovary, instead of being round or oval and nice and smooth, was very lumpy. And they knew that these were cysts, so they thought that the hirsutism and the lack of periods was due to the cysts in the ovaries. So since there was more than one of them, they called it polycystic ovarian syndrome, and that's where the term PCOS came from. But since it was also named after them, Stein-Leventhal syndrome, if somebody Googles that, that's what comes up. What they did not realize is that the cysts on the ovaries was just part of the symptomatology, not the origin of the problem. And the cysts on the surface had to do the fact with that every month, if you can just generically can call women has cycles, say maybe from age, let's just say 12 to 50. Okay, nice. So when you start ovulating as a 12-year-old during the first half of the 28 to 31 to 2-day cycle, you are developing follicles with inside your ovary, and the follicle-stimulating hormone, which is the FSH that we may measure in the first half of the cycle, is helping a main dominant follicle to develop, which then goes to the surface of the ovary, and then at mid-cycle, cycle, or what we call ovulation, there is a surge of LH, or luteinizing hormone, which tells the follicle to release from the ovary and then travel through the fallopian tube and then down into the uterus, where then it depends upon whether or not, you know, they have a blind date and they meet some sperm that are looking also for a blind date, and they hook up together and the woman gets pregnant. If there are no sperm, whatever, follicle then still keeps going through and passes through, and the person does not become pregnant. But in the case of this polycystic ovarian syndrome, one of the hormonal balances that we find is that there is an abnormal ratio of the follicle-stimulating hormone to the luteinizing hormone. In other words, we're looking for the ratio of FSH to LH. In the first part of the cycle, you will pretty much see that as a 1-to-1 ratio. And then when the person gets ready for ovulation, mid-cycle, there is a huge surge in the LH, which is like the megaphone to the ovary that says release and travel about the country. The problem with people who have this polycystic ovarian syndrome is that they have an elevated LHFS ratio during the first half of the cycle. Some people will be very, very strict and say they need to see a 3-to-1 ratio for it to be PCOS. In other words, 3 times the level of LH to FSH, which is a clue. Why is this so important? Is because if the LH is elevated, then you cannot have that surge of the LH mid-cycle. The analogy that I give with that is if you are in a very, very quiet room, you can hear a little thing drop to the floor. And if you are trying to take a light nap, it may startle you and wake you up. But if you are trying to take a nap in where there is stereo playing in the background with the volume turned up and you're sleeping, are you going to hear that little thing drop on the floor and wake you up? So I view the LH as the loud music in the background all of the time, so it doesn't hear even maybe that little bump up in the LH that says release the follicle. So what happens is it doesn't get released. It's on the surface waiting for that call, but it's never released, so it just stays on the surface. The next month, the same process occurs, and another follicle is at the surface waiting, but it doesn't get released. So over time, what happens is many, many follicles then just get to that stopping point at the surface of the ovary and never gets released. So therefore, that's where we get the terminology polycystic ovaries, and it's not the only cause, but I would say it's 95% of the cause of the polycystic ovaries.
Well, let's review what the heck some is of the person doesn't want to get.
Right. Yes, that's what I was going to say. You know, a person may say, "Well, if a person doesn't want to get pregnant, you know, what's the major problem? It doesn't release." Well, the problem is that when it is released, it is that follicle that turns into the corpus luteum, which then secretes progesterone. During the second half of a woman's cycle, progesterone is supposed to be the major dominant hormone. In the first half of the cycle, it's estrogen. Second half is progesterone, which is reasons behind that is that it actually is priming if the person does become pregnant, the progesterone primes the inside of the uterine lining to hold on to and maintain the pregnancy. If the person doesn't become pregnant, then the main reason for the progesterone is to act as a system of checks and balances with the estrogen so that the person does not remain estrogen dominant through the whole entire cycle. It is also felt that progesterone is very, very protective of the estrogen receptors throughout the body. We have estrogen receptors basically everywhere, but of course the dominant places we think of it is in the breast and in the uterus. So think of it this way as an imbalance. If a person does not ovulate and they do not secrete progesterone, that means if you can, you know, have a little camera inside, you are going to see that estrogen remains dominant and elevated throughout the whole entire cycle, cycle after cycle after cycle. And these are the women that, if they don't get any periods, they're building up the lining of the uterus, getting ready for a pregnancy, but then it never releases. And that is the reason why people who have polycystic ovarian syndrome and do not have periods for a long period of time, all of that chronic estrogen stimulation of the inside of the uterine actually is a huge risk factor for what we call endometrial cancer.
So there's where we're coming to some of the
endometrial cancer. But there is, I know that this is done in a lot of OBGYN practices, and I know that they are doing it to be protective and prevent it. But women who present that they just don't ovulate at all, they don't, you know, they're not going to get pregnant, but they don't want them to go more than really 3 months without a period. So what they'll do is they will put them on what they call a progestin challenge. Now, progesterone is what is secreted naturally in the body, but there are companies that have changed the molecular structure a little bit and have made it, one of the things is called this Provera, if people have heard that out there. So it is chemically altered, but it will do the same thing. They'll do what's known as the Provera challenge. They'll put them on 10 days of Provera, which artificially increases the progesterone level, and when you stop it, what it does is it creates a withdrawal bleed. So that is one of what I call the band-aids that we have done for PCOS. Decreasing, yes, it does have a reason to decrease the risk of endometrial cancer, but it does not take care of the underlying problem. And I know a little later on during this hour here, I really want to go into how I approach the woman who says, okay, I don't want to get pregnant right now, but in a number of years I would be ready to. And my other doctor tells me I'm not ovulating at all. How do you treat me functionally for this? How do you cure the underlying problem so that the decision when I want to become pregnant is mine?
And right, that's but that's one only one aspect, as you said. What about the fact that so many of these women and the girls that I see come in, some of them are actually happy about the pregnancy protective effect about the condition, but they're not too happy about the hirsutism and obesity and some of the other things that are linked
to
it.
So the did you want me to get into that right now?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So one of the biggest underlying problems with this is what's known as insulin resistance, or the body secretes a lot of insulin because they are insulin resistant. It's a compensatory mechanism, and they secrete a lot of insulin to try to overcome this insulin resistance to drive some blood sugar into the cells. And you could say, well, how in the world is that related? Well, the thing is that I do measure insulin levels in my patients. I will do what's known as an insulin glucose tolerance test. And
wait, can you say that test again? Is that something that people can...
Right. It's not a glucose tolerance test because that only measures the glucose levels in response to a 300-calorie challenge of a pure glucose solution. But it's called the insulin glucose tolerance test, so that they are measuring simultaneous insulin levels. So look to see how much insulin the body has to secrete to try to overcome the insulin resistance to help drive the blood sugar into the cells, is where it's supposed to go to help with energy metabolism. So they'll look for the insulin resistance. So I can have multiple patients with exactly the same curve for blood sugars because I tell you, God programmed the beta cells in the pancreas to be really, really smart. And they try to secrete as much insulin as needed to maintain normal blood sugars. So typically we are talking about these women, they are not diabetic. And I hear this over and over again. They go, oh, we did the glucose tolerance test and your blood sugars are okay. You do not have a problem in that area. Well, if you had looked at the simultaneous insulin levels, you would have seen that those insulin levels shot up to try to maintain normal glucose levels. Hence, where the problem lies with this is a person who is extremely insulin resistant, and we can get into afterwards the underlying factors that contribute to that, but their high insulin levels is what's contributing 95% of the time to the symptomatology that we see with the high PCOS syndrome type symptoms. The increased insulin levels actually increase the androgen levels in the body. One of the ways that it can do that is high insulin levels decrease what's known as sex hormone binding globulin in our body. Now, when I talk about high androgen levels, you know, everybody thinks as androgen levels associated with males. And of course, you know, males should be androgen dominant and estrogen not dominant, and women, you know, more of, you know, estrogen in their body and less of the androgens. All women have androgens in their body, have testosterone.
As all men have estrogen,
DHEA.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, as all men do have low levels of estrogen. The only problem is when their estrogens are higher than their testosterones, they have problems, but that's another whole hour lecture. So with the women who have the elevated androgens, because the insulin decreases the sex hormone binding globulin, which just as the name implies, is that it binds to the sex hormone or the androgens in the body and deactivates it or binds it up so it is not considered active to the cells. So what is the problem with that? Well, a woman can have, say, a normal, regular testosterone level, but if they have very, very, very low sex hormone binding globulin, what it does is it makes that testosterone more free and active. And then a great analogy I use is, what happens to a 13-year-old boy when they're starting going through their puberty stage? What hormone is going up in their body? Testosterone. What do you typically see on the face of boys entering puberty, 13, 14, 15? You will see the beginning of facial hair, but you can also see the beginning of acne. And so I usually look at, you know, the boys that have a lot of acne, is they're going through their puberty, but they're probably also living on soda, which increases their insulin levels. It decreases their sex hormone binding globulin too. And then they have actually even higher levels of testosterone. And then they get put on retin A, they get put on a whole bunch of other things that they have to check their liver function test. Again, they get put on medications to try to band-aid or subdue the symptomatology. But I find the same thing with women. Women will be put on retin A, they'll be put on all these things. They'll have cosmetic peels, all sorts of things to try to control the acne, but the acne is coming from the inside out. And if you looked at the high insulin levels, and I can actually measure the sex hormone binding globulin, I will find really, really low levels. So one of the aims of what I want to do with these patients is I want to decrease the amount of surging of insulin during the day. And what surges insulin? High glycemic foods. So the first thing I do with these patients, with the patients, clients, people who come to me in consultation, is that I try to change their whole diet around so they are staying away from the white flour products.
Okay, let's just take you know, it might actually be a good place right here to take a break, so that when we come back, what we'll do is we'll go into, you know, what kind of therapies. You mentioned it very briefly, like you brought up soda, for instance. I mean, you certainly never hear that at a doctor's office, stop drinking soda, and yet it is a huge and main intervention if people are drinking six cans of soda a day, or one of those big 16-ounce glasses that Bloomberg tried to limit. I'm not so into someone else trying to limit it. You can limit it yourself, but nonetheless.
That's true. I think, you know, I'll leave with this before we go to the break, is that what I try to do is give the person the information and empower them to make good decisions to improve their health status.
Exactly. So we're going to take a little break here where we listen to lots of information about other wonderful shows that you can hear right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with advanced nurse practitioner Rebecca Murray. I think you're getting a sense of her deep level of commitment and knowledge. And we'll talk about, you know, simple steps that you can take to decrease this problem, PCOS, and also will help with every other chronic disease. That's what's great about integrative interventions. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're back right now with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can tune in every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., to listen to more information about natural medicine. Dr. Zamperone and myself have been bringing you this information really quite a long time. We started our first radio show in the late 1970s, believe it or not, when radio used to be on the radio. But now, of course, you can catch The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on our podcast anytime at Progressive Radio Network. Just go to prn.fm, click on shows, and you'll come down to Natural Nurse. And we have all of our shows archived there. And then there's a way you can get to the older archives as well, if the ones that are readily accessible don't fill your time up. And today we have as our guest a wonderful advanced practice nurse practitioner, Rebecca Murray. We have her bio, her full bio listed, will be listed on the archived show. But I do want to tell her that she has shared with us a way you can get in touch with her, and that is called Ward Murray, WardMurrayHCC, at yahoo.com. That's Ward Murray HCC at yahoo.com. And thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about cardiac health, and then we switched to a focused topic of PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. You talked about something. This is why I love doing radio. I didn't realize that how the name of this syndrome came about, although I do know people did suffer from it, but they're just talking about a symptom, not really what's going on. Now, let's talk about what you would do as an intervention. And what I find so fascinating is the same thing that you're going to talk about that would help this condition would also be good for those cardiac patients had they done it earlier on.
Well, that is true because of the fact that you just mentioned cardiac, is that insulin resistance is the main component of what we call metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome, if I can just give credit where it is due, metabolic syndrome, originally known as Syndrome X, was first presented in 1988 at the American Diabetes Association by Dr. Gerald Reaven, who did his presentation of his lifetime work out of Stanford University, looking at the role of chronic hyperinsulinemia and how it affects the body. And a few of the effects are is that increased insulin levels increase triglycerides, decrease the production of HDL. So when you look at people who have a chronic cardiac risk, okay, what is it that we look at in the blood work? It's not just the total cholesterol. You look at the ratio with the HDL, and that's why it's known as the HDL cholesterol ratio. When you could have two people, whether they're women or men, say a number of 200. They both have 200, but one person has an HDL or the protective cholesterol of 90, and you say, wow, 90 out of 200, my goodness, that is good protection, low cardiovascular risk. The other person can have a cholesterol of 200 and have an HDL, and I have seen this, of 25. Look at the difference. Look at the ratio. I call HDL homeland security. So that when your homeland security is really, really down, you are increasing the risk of cardiovascular disease to come in and take over your body. So one of the things that's so important about decreasing, the other thing it can do is cause hypertension. And Dr. Reaven went into all of the physiologic basis of how high insulin levels increase sodium retention. So what do we put patients on with hypertension? We put them on diuretics to get rid of fluid, right? And decrease the sodium. So, and another thing that it does is it causes vasoconstriction. So what do we put patients on with hypertension? Is we put them on vasodilators, okay? The other thing that high insulin levels can do is increases their clotting. So it increases their risk of what we call an embolic phenomena, and that is a clot that goes to some part in the body, and that could be a deep vein thrombophlebitis. It could be a pulmonary embolus. It could be going to the coronary artery and blocking that off and causing major heart attack, or it could go to the middle cerebral artery, block that off, and cause a major stroke, none of which you really, really want to experience.
So, right, so listen, you know what, before we run out of time,
yeah,
believe it or not, we're getting to the end of the show, so I want you to what the treatment protocol might look like.
Did you see my point about what I'm going to talk about with decreasing the insulin levels has an overall effect in the body?
On everything, yes.
On everything, so not just PCOS. It protects the body. So I tell my patients they need to go on a low-glycemic diet. That means getting rid of the processed food. It means getting rid of the sodas. It also means getting rid of what they call the fruit juices. I always love these, you know, bright blue colored things that says 10% fruit juice and the rest of it is high fructose corn syrup. All of these things, and it doesn't have to be sweet. Everybody thinks if it's sweet, they should avoid it. But the processed foods that are the white flour products also break down, a flour molecule breaks down to two glucose molecules rapidly in the stomach. And that raises the blood sugar, which then raises the response from the pancreas to secrete more insulin level. So the thing is that I put them on an adequate protein and low glycemic, lots of vegetables, which are very low glycemic, and fruit is limited to the whole entire fruit and more of the lower glycemic, like apples and grapefruits and things like this. So, you know, the old thing about five a day of fruits and vegetables, I say I'd love to see it four vegetables and one whole fruit. So that's one of the things that I do is I try to decrease the insulin levels, and I've actually seen a rise in the sex hormone binding globulin with that. One of the other things that I find, because people really want to see quick, you know, they want to see results sooner. So one of the things that I also try to do is I try to prevent the conversion of testosterone to what's known as DHT or dihydrotestosterone, which is the active component in the sebaceous follicles in the skin. And that is what increases the sebum production, so it increases the acne, or it's the same follicle that increases the hirsutism. What I find in women with PCOS is they present more with the acne. You may see some hirsutism, especially in what we call the androgen dominant parts of the body. So you can see it along the umbilicus. You can see it along the linea, you know, around the belly button. You can see it like maybe sideburns. When I see women when I'm going into the store and they've got the 5 o'clock shadow, because when they shave that morning it's already starting to grow in, you know that woman has a major problem with DHT and androgen production and their things. But I try to do things, and there's natural things try to do that. Chrysin is one of the things that helps to do that.
What is that?
What else?
Chrysin?
Is that something? Chrysin is a natural, and then the other thing, I use chrysin for a number of things. The other thing that chrysin is really, really probably most known for is actually trying to decrease the conversion of androgens in the body. Remember I said they already have high androgens, and converting them into estrogens. And
so Rebecca, spell like chrysin for us. Is that a product?
Or is it it's a natural thing, chrysin.
Okay.
It's C-H-R-Y-S-I-N. I give that to my patients. Again, I am trying to, the main focus is with diet. I have found people that are completely anovulatory, and I get them to lose, 20 pounds of fat, and all of a sudden they're ovulating on their own, because what they've done is they've changed their diet, they've decreased their fat storage, they lose weight, and then, you know, they take care of the problem on itself. Another thing that I use, and actually what it's called is, in the body, it is a enzyme that's called aromatase, and it is in the fat cells in the body, and what it does is it converts androgens to estrogens in the body. So Natural aromatase inhibitors could include things like, again, chrysin and also resveratrol. The resveratrol is the active component in wine. I give my patients resveratrol. I tell them that they can get a lot of the benefits that the French people do from drinking red wine. I'm not proposing that they go out and drink two bottles of wine with dinner to have the same effect. So it's wonderful that they've been actually able to isolate that. The other thing I tell my patients is not everything is created equal. I'm not telling them to go to, you know, a huge discount store and find something that, you know, they can buy in a bottle for 99 cents. I always say you get what you pay for. So it's actually important that the products contain quality assurance documented, that it has adequate amounts of the active component of the resveratrol. So these are things, I'm just giving you really the Reader's Digest condensed
right.
version
now, so
of what
course,
I may do with
diet
my patients.
Is hugely
it's
important,
foremost,
as you said.
Foremost.
Now, what
yeah.
about exercise?
Exercise is good, too, but I have to tell you, and this is the example I say, as far as I'm concerned, diet is number one, because if it was just lack of exercise, then everybody in a wheelchair that's a paraplegic would be obese. So exercise is very important in terms of trying to increase your metabolic rate, increasing your cardiac tolerance. It is wonderful. But I have to tell you, when I have somebody come to me, a woman that's 350 pounds, for them exercise is getting off the couch and moving to the other side of the room. So I actually really need to start on improving their diet and also supplementing whatever nutrient deficiencies that they have.
And how about stress reduction?
Would
that be appropriate?
Stress actually increases the body's cortisol production in the body. I always say, you know, stress is not what is done to you. It's how you perceive what is done to you. Because what one person may find is exhilarating and endorphin loading, the other person can find very, very stressful, which then sends a message to the adrenal glands to secrete more cortisol. We know that cortisol shunts fat deposition to the abdomen, but what a lot of people do not realize is that high cortisol levels actually increase insulin resistance. And how do we know this? If you take a diabetic that is well controlled with their blood sugars, and say they develop a huge case of poison ivy, and they are put on prednisone, which is like a steroid. You know, it is a steroid. Our body produces steroids or cortisol when we're stressed. But if you put them on prednisone, guess what's going to happen to their diabetes blood sugar control? The blood sugars are going to go up. They did not change anything else except increasing the steroid level in their body. So when people are very, very, very stressed and they have a compensatory increased release of cortisol from their adrenal glands, it will actually increase their insulin resistance.
Well, believe it or not, we are at the end of our show. Thank you so much for being our guest. Excellent, excellent information. We have been listening to Rebecca Murray, advanced nurse practitioner, who has been sharing a lot of really scientific information. You guys may want to listen to it again, and you certainly can. And you can contact Rebecca
through email. Yes, through email.
Yeah, through email only, and that's Ward Murray, WardMurrayHCC at yahoo.com. Yes, we did not share your other information because I know how overwhelmed you are. And now you can stay up all night answering emails.
Night,
oh,
and I
goodness.
Can answer emails.
Well, thank you again so much for being our guest. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Visit us at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or naturalnurse.com. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.